It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. For the first time in 27 years, the Urban League of Greater Pittsburgh will have a new leader. Esther Bush, a fixture in the Pittsburgh community, is retiring as president and CEO of the Urban League this fall. The board found her successor right here in Pittsburgh. Carlos Carter will take over as president and CEO November 10th. Welcome back to the Confluence, Carlos.
Thank you so much, Kevin. It's always a pleasure to be here.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
You are a native Pittsburgher. You obviously know this region. Esther Bush has been a force in this community for 2.5 decades at the Urban League. How important is it to have her involved in your transition into this leadership post?
I don't take it lightly, you know, following in the footsteps and standing on the shoulders of a community icon and champion like Esther. And so definitely I need her support. But just as she told me, she's not going to get in my way. You know, I'm going to be the new leader, but I definitely, rely on her to bring me up to speed on everything. I have a lot to learn. And so I want to approach this position with humility. You know, I want to look, listen, and learn. You know, I think that's part of my approach. I don't have all the answers, but so he is very important, especially for me as a Black man, right? And even my decision to even accept this position, it's a heavy load to lift, but I know I don't have to carry it alone. It takes a village. And so I work with that village.
Who else will you learn from?
Well, I'll learn from the board, the team, community members, from individuals and communities to politicians to all of Pittsburgh, to be honest, because it's important that I do listen to people. And that don't mean I'll do everything they say. But as a leader, you know, they would tell you the Homeless Children's Education Fund. I do try my best to listen to my team. And then I step back and make an informed decision. So I'm never a puppet. But I believe the great leaders do listen. You know, poor leaders think they have all the answer. And I'm not going to say what type of leader I am. I think that's for others to judge. But I am a leader who is a leader of the people. I try my best to show humility and listen, to be kind, but also to make tough decisions as well, and to be able to speak truth to power and to hold people accountable, including myself.
As we speak, you are wrapping up your time as executive director of the Homeless Children's Education Fund.
Yes.
You've also served as a consultant for Holy Family Institute, held various positions in the banking industry. What do you think you bring from those various experiences to help you lead one of the more influential organizations in this region?
Yeah, I believe I bring a lot of perspective, right? And I think there's this division or divide between a nonprofit world and a for-profit world, but we need everyone, right? Like I tell everybody, we don't need everybody to go in a nonprofit world. We need for-profit, we need money to actually do what we do. I think we need to work together. And so I think I've seen the best and worst of humanity in both sectors. But I think, again, I've learned to be open and learn different perspectives.
Carlos, in June, I spoke with Esther Bush when it was announced that she was retiring. And she told us, if we look at Pittsburgh, we have every single thing we need to make it a good place for everybody to live. Pittsburgh can do better. What is your role in helping Pittsburgh to do better?
Again, I believe my role is to listen, to learn, and to implement the things that I learn through my leadership to, again, continue to elevate the strengths of Black people, right? I feel like my job is to sound the alarm that, like, we need to bring Black people to the table. We don't need Black people just in D&I positions. That's great and it's important, but we need to be in other parts of the C-suite as well. We're not one-trick ponies. And just realizing that we are better together and that we can't, you know, I'm proud of the Ed Meds and Techs and all that. I think is amazing. But if significant groups of populations are left behind, and specifically Black people and people of color, then I think that that's something that needs to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. Esther emphasized that all individuals, businesses, and corporations can accept and should act to improve life for all Pittsburghers in the city. As a Black man who comes from the corporate sector, as a Black leader in the nonprofit sector, do you feel, have you experienced a willingness to do that for all the businesses and corporations to come together?
I'd say there's a lot more work to do. I wouldn't say no one's doing that, but I feel like I feel like there's so many studies and a study after study and committee after committee, but we need action. And so not to say the studies aren't important, because I believe data is important. Data is important to inform decision-making. Knowledge is power, but the application of knowledge is even more powerful. And so we need to apply the things that we know and realize, you know, if you're a leader and you look around your company and everybody looks like you, you shouldn't feel comfortable looking yourself in the mirror every day. You need to know, what can I do? I always say we need to approach people with empathy and inquiry. So we need to always be asking questions about what's going on. But how can I, as a leader, promote diversity and inclusion? How can I build wealth? Face it, if you don't have life-sustaining wages, how are you to build wealth? Or if you don't have the resources to start a business. And, you know, I definitely would like to see more Black businesses, but I just want to see Black people thrive. I want to see all people thrive, but more specifically, you know, Black people. You know, my vision is that Pittsburgh is livable for all, right? That people can succeed despite their race, socioeconomic status, gender, sexual orientation, or zip code, you know? And so Black people especially should not be excluded from that. And right now, based on the data, not on my opinion, we are. And that needs to change.
The Urban League of Greater Pittsburgh's been around for 103 years.
Yes,
newer
yes.
Newer groups such as Black Lives Matter, Black Young and Educated, coordinated by younger folks, took the lead for demonstrations for racial and social justice. Where do you think the Urban League fits among these groups that are presenting themselves as extremely active and visible to younger Pittsburghers? And do you think the Urban League needs to adapt to this new generation?
Well, as you know, the Urban League is part of the National Urban League, and a lot of times the Urban League works behind the scenes. But for me, it is very important that we do collaborate with younger voices. You know, some of them know the Urban League exists and some don't, or even some people my age, they don't know what they do. I talk to another Urban leader, said a lot of times people don't think the Urban League is doing enough. A lot of times people don't know the things the Urban League is doing behind the scenes, or I want to do a job, a good job of bringing that to the forefront. You know, telling the stories of the people we serve is important, like just the ATF, and humanizing the people we serve. But I think it's critical that we have these young people be members of the Urban League, and that we learn from them and work with them, and that we be open to different things. I think that's critical, because I feel like if anything isn't innovating, you can be left behind and be seen as irrelevant. I just want people to continue to see that relevancy, and that we learn and work together with others. But we can't leave our young people, right? I'm not going to live forever. And so I think if we're not incorporating young people, that's a problem.
Carlos Carter becomes the new president and CEO of the Urban League of Greater Pittsburgh November 10th. Carlos, thanks so much for your time.
A pleasure. Always a pleasure, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Mary Lee Williams. The population of women in Pennsylvania's state correctional institutions grew by 5% from 2010 to 2019, according to the State Department of Corrections. In comparison, the population of men in state prisons dropped by 11% over the same period. The state is looking to reentry programs and training to try and address female incarceration. So, what's being done? Jill McCorkle is a professor of criminology and sociology at Villanova University and is the founding director of the Philadelphia Justice Project for Women and Girls. And Valerie Todd is an advocate supporting women in reentry with housing, jobs, services, and treatment. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Both of you are part of the ACLU's Incarcerated Women's Working Group. Can you tell me just briefly what that is?
It's women that have been formerly incarcerated, as well as the ACLU, putting our minds together to create positive change for women coming home, women who are in there, incarcerated, just simple things, even coming home and not having cosmetics or not having transportation or not knowing where you're going to live or reunifying with your family. And we just come together and try to find solutions.
So, Valerie, you were incarcerated in 2010 and completed parole in 2017. What kind of supports did you have access to when you were reentering your community?
My ties of family were just completely gone. And I was put into a CCC center with pretty much, you're just starting with nothing. If you don't have an attitude of determination and have strength inside of you, without the proper support, you could actually, you know, feel lost. But I thank God because I did have a good attitude. I was determined. And I also, there was reentry supports, like there's Ardella's House, Sisters Returning Home, Mothers in Charge, that helped you with like employment, resumes, and just supported you through counseling and things of that nature.
Jill, for women who are getting out of prison today, what kind of supports are typical that they would see on their way out of the facility?
Well, the problem facing women today is the problem that has faced women historically who are coming out of jails and prison facilities, which is it's dependent on your jurisdiction. And by and large, there's been really a lack of services for women who are coming home. There's patchwork available, and so that might include drug treatment programming. That might include services that help women get kids back, because very often women lose custody of their children during their prison sentence. There are also programs that deal with finding employment and housing. The problem with housing for women is that very often housing services don't accept women's children. And so there's really specific ways in which women are disadvantaged as they come out relative to men. The other issue is real lack of understanding gender and women's specific needs, particularly around caregiving and kids.
To both of you, and we'll start with Valerie, what are some specific needs that women who are re-entering the community have?
It's really scary. Because when you're coming from a state facility, you've done more than a year. So unless you're coming out to employment, clothing, cosmetics, a vehicle, there's a lack of resources and gender, yes. Everything is like designed for the men, but women have a whole different set of needs. Mental health, self-care, all that stuff is just, if you don't have things set up for you and if you don't have somebody who can motivate you, encourage you, and because, you know, you get put in these centers coming home. If you don't have a house, you get put in a center in whatever, you know, area that center is located with. You know, I had 7 roommates and 6 of them were using drugs. It was about me keeping my mindset on staying focused. You know, I didn't have clothes or anything like that, so I had to depend on donations. I did get put on a housing list. I never ever got housing, even though I had 4 children. It took me years to be reconciled to my children. I was only allowed to see them once a week. It's emotional health as well, because it was hard to leave my kids and go back to that CCC center. You know, food, every basic need is like not really met coming home. It's such an adjustment. It's traumatic. You went from the frying pan into the fire coming home.
Jill?
I mean, the other thing that is happening here is that, you know, women, when they're coming home, are often prey for men who they might have been in past relationships with, for other men who are, you know, either in the community-based facility, in a sort of, for, you know, a partner community-based facility, or on the street. And because women are facing so many challenges economically and in terms of, you know, emotional support, there are plenty of men that are looking to take advantage of that. And that's another thing that just doesn't get addressed either in these centers or in a lot of reentry programming.
What are some of the reasons from maybe your research or your experience that the population of incarcerated women in state prisons was increasing from 2010 to 2019, while the men's population was decreasing?
You know, over the course of those 2 decades, we've seen the prison population overall peak and then start to decline. But when you disaggregate those declining prison populations by gender, what we see in a number of states is that the number of men going to prison has decreased. The number of women going to prison has remained either the same or in some cases, like Pennsylvania, has actually increased. But here's the puzzle. Women's crimes are less serious, less frequent, and less violent than men's. And in fact, women's crime participation hasn't changed over this period. So really, the increase in women's crime is an artifact of crime policies, particularly mandatory minimum sentencing policies, where, women haven't really changed their criminal behavior. What's changed is the sentencing around them. And then there's been a lack of attention to how this is playing out in the women's institutions. And that lack of attention is at the level of policy, but it's also from, progressive reform efforts. Most of those efforts are directed at men. And so women have really been left behind sort of efforts to reform the prison system and the criminal legal system more generally.
Do you think one of the issues that you guys are running into is that these programs were designed for men and then simply adapted, like just simply reapplied to women?
Yeah, when you actually look at the programming that does exist, when you look at the modality and the history of that particular modality, almost without fail, it's based on a model that's been used for men, and then very often it's sort of really crude efforts to make it gender specific to women. But there's a number of studies that suggest that kind of like add gender and stir mix to a treatment modality is not appropriate and not terribly effective.
So Valerie, First Lady Frances Wolfe is hosting a series of conversations about women in reentry and how best to serve them. Some might see this as a moment as shining a light on the issues of women in reentry. If you had to point out some very concrete things that you want the First Lady and other policymakers to know about, what would you point to?
I would say housing and trauma therapy. Housing is the biggest fear for a woman coming home. Just having access or quicker housing, because if you feel like you're going to be homeless and then you got children that you're working to unify, it makes you anxious. It could just really take you off your square.
So Jill, you've written about how the COVID-19 crisis is not just about physical health in prisons and jails, but also mental, which touches on what Valerie's saying. For people getting out now, how is COVID-19 affecting their experience?
It's pretty bleak, and it's visible, on the streets in Philadelphia. The limited number of mental health and rehabilitative services that were in play, a lot of them are gone now. You can see visibly an uptick in not only homelessness, but also, really significant mental health crises. And then with that, a really significant crisis around substance abuse. And so I'm very, very concerned that we've sort of lost our way here, in that the services that are most desperately needed are the ones that have been disappearing really rapidly. And these problems are going to compound, because it just means that people are cycling back into a system that is causing them tremendous harm.
So, Jill, you're saying that the services of mental health treatment and substance abuse treatments aren't there when people leave state facilities.
Right. There's really been, limitations on the number of programs that are available. And those programs were already strapped and kind of at maximum capacity. They weren't able to fill the demand that exists out there. But that demand has just gotten worse at a moment in time where services themselves have contracted and shrunk. And so, of course, on the street, there is an uptick in violence, there's an uptick in substance abuse, there's an uptick in homelessness and mental health crises, all of which make the problem that much more severe, both in the facilities, which we're seeing, you know, in the jail facility out in Allegheny County, as well as in the jail facilities in Philadelphia. And then, of course, it compounds again on the street.
Finally, in the next 5 years, how would you like to see reentry programs for women change in Pennsylvania? Jill, we'll start with you and then we'll go to Valerie.
I would like to see far fewer women incarcerated in the first place in Pennsylvania. The dramatic explosion of the number of women behind bars has absolutely nothing to do with women's crime participation. So before we even get to the issue of reentry, I want to drastically reduce the number of women that find themselves in this particular situation, because the situation doesn't solve anyone's problem, and it actually makes problems worse. You know, first things first, there is a very real housing crisis, particularly for women, and particularly for women with kids under the age of 18. And so that housing crisis has to be front and center for women who are coming out. And the other set of crises are really things around resources.
The separation from women and their children is just the shame, the guilt, the trauma, all that's attached to that. Like having maybe more access to women and children facilities, housing, and reuniting the mothers with their children coming home are huge.
Jill McCorkle is a professor of criminology and sociology at Villanova University and the founding director of the Philadelphia Justice Project for Women and Girls. And Valerie Todd is an advocate supporting women in reentry with housing, job services, and treatment. Thank you guys both for talking to me.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Rebecca Reese, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.